From SGI USA, I'm Cassidy Bradford, and this is Bootability, the weekly series where I talk with Buddhists from all walks of life about the power we each have to change our lives and the world around us. When I was younger, I was afraid of falling asleep. And then I was afraid of fish. After that, butterflies. But like many of you who responded to this week's question about fears, my fears have become a little more abstract. Some of you are afraid of failure. Others, love. But the most common response we got was the fear of loss, losing self-confidence, losing yourself. And like today's guest, the fear of losing someone you love. Today, I'm talking with John Plummer of Cold Spring, New York, about how he faced that fear and continues to face that fear head on.
My name is John Plummer. I live in Cold Spring, New York, which is in the Hudson Valley, about an hour and change north of New York City. I am a writer. I write mostly for television.
To kind of open things up, I would love to hear about how you encountered Buddhism and why you started practicing. I know it's a very kind of interesting journey, so.
Yeah, I mean, I first heard about Nam-myoho Renge Kyo when I was in college at Tufts University. I heard about it from a guy that I became really good friends with. We got cast together in a show, and he had just started chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo 2 weeks before he met me. And we became very good friends, did all kinds of stuff together creatively over the next 2 years. He introduced a lot of people to Buddhism and to this practice of chanting. And I was definitely not one of the people he introduced because, in fact, I tried to convince him to stop practicing Buddhism. And I made a plan that I was going to go over to his apartment when I knew he was going to be home alone so I could really confront him. I was going to do it. I was going to absolutely convince him to stop. And so that's what I did. And he very wisely and compassionately said to me, "Wow, man, that means so much to me that you care about me so much. Please don't worry about me. I'm fine. And I'm going to keep practicing Buddhism, but you're really a great friend." I had nothing to say to that, you know. And then, of course, we started a theater company together, a Shakespeare company, and we worked together on many, many projects. And he would always, very often, he would go off and chant during lunch break, or if things were tense, he'd go sit in his car and chant, you know, and I would just be rolling my eyes at this foolishness. What a ridiculous, you know, waste of time. But I couldn't deny that I noticed changes happening in his life. He had always struggled with being on time, and he suddenly became always on time and, like, really good at being on time and lots of other things. Eventually, he went off to drama school in London, which is actually where I am right now. And I mean in London, not drama school. And this mutual friend of ours went with him. And that we had worked together in our Shakespeare company. And then I heard she's practicing Buddhism. And I went, oh, no, you know, this is terrible. And then she and I, a couple of years later, started dating. And I really liked her a lot. So I was, on the outside, I was being very cool about the fact that she would wake up every morning and chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, and I would lay there in the bed and read or something. But again, on the inside of me, I was like, oh, how can I convince her to stop? And the only way I thought I could convince her is I needed ammo. So I started reading her SGI Buddhist magazine that she would get every month. Again, waited till she was out of the house. I didn't want her to think I was interested. Heaven forfend that. So I would wait till she was out of the house. And I read this, you know, essay. I remember the first essay I read, Daisaku Ikeda, the Buddhist philosopher, had written the essay. It was translated. And the first thing he did was quote the founder of the Soka Gakkai, Sunesaburo Makaguchi, who said, roughly, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, a religious organization should work for the happiness of its members and not the other way around. Any religious organization that doesn't put the happiness of its members in the forefront should be immediately disbanded. And I was like, whoa, I completely concur with that idea. And then the more I read, the more I was like, oh, I really agree with a lot of this stuff. And then I started to meet her friends who would come over and chant with her, and I liked them, and they were diverse. I mean, not just ethnically diverse, but different backgrounds, different life experiences, and they were cool. And nobody was asking me, why don't you chant? Nobody was pressuring me at all. They were just nice and cool and thoughtful and interesting. So I started to melt a little bit, you know, all my frigidness. But I was even there when she received her Gohonzon, which is the mandala that SGI Buddhists chant, looking at that as a focal point. You know, it's a beautiful pictograph. And I just sat there with my arms folded, and these very nice English people were giving me these Nam-myoho Renge-kyo cards, showing me this is what we're chanting. And I was like, I got it. No thanks. And I refused to chant, even though I was in a room full of hundreds of people chanting this vibration. And so eventually, and I'm coming to the end of this stem winder of a tale, but eventually she and I had moved back to New York. We were engaged to be married, and we'd planned a big non-denominational wedding ceremony. And then we were walking to a rehearsal, and we were living with my parents because we were very broke in an apartment on the Upper West Side. And we're walking up Central Park West, and she says to me, I've thought about this a lot. There's a very simple Buddhist wedding ceremony based on a tea ceremony, and I would really like to have that at the SGI New York Culture Center. And I said, well, we can't do that. We've already sent out the invitation. And she said, no, it's very simple. We can invite a few friends and our parents and have it the week before our big wedding. And I said, I don't want to do that. And she said, why? Why don't you want to do this? And then we walked for several blocks. And the more we walked and the more I thought, I am really afraid. And I don't even know what I'm afraid of. And that's not okay. So, okay, then we should do this. So I said to her, okay, let's do it. And she said, really? And I said, yes. Absolutely. But I want to know what I'm doing. You know, I don't just want to be a bystander at my own ceremony. And she said, oh, wow. Amazing. Great. We can start tomorrow. So I thought start tomorrow meant we're going to study. We're going to really, because I love to study. But in fact, what start tomorrow meant was we were going to chant Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. And we sat down in front of her altar, because SGI Buddhists set up these altars in their homes so that they don't have to wait to go to a community center to practice. They can just chant wherever they are, and which she did every day. And she said, why don't we chant for about 15 minutes? Is that okay? And I said, okay. And I was scared, but I was excited. There was something bubbling up in me. And keep in mind, this is now 10 years after I had met my friend at Tufts University, 10 years later.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how long it took. So we chanted together. And, you know, she went very slowly at first, and then together, you know. And at first I was trying to, like, just catch the words and stick with it. But pretty soon it was a flow. It was coming out of me. And, you know, at some point she rang the bell, and I was like, was that 15 minutes? And she said, yes, it was. And I said, wow. And she said, I mean, I'll never forget this. She said, how do you feel? And I said, I feel like this is something I need to do for my life. And that was how I felt. Because what had happened while I was chanting was I realized this overwhelming fear that I had. You know, in a way, this Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, these words I was learning to say, it was like they were just flooding over all that fear, and just like a river that was just covering it over. And I just, you know, and it wasn't washing the fear away, but it was like warmth almost. You know, I felt warm, and I felt a sense of almost joy, really. I think that's really what I felt. And also a sense of wonder. I mean, myoho, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, myoho means wonderful law or mystic law. It can be translated either way. But wonderful, of course, means full of wonder. And that's what I felt, really. And so that's why, and that was, gosh, almost 20, it was 29 years ago this month, actually. Anyway, that's my story of how I started practicing.
Wow. I really love the imagery of like this wave. And yeah, not like erasing the fear, right? But kind of like maybe embracing it or like,
That was definitely it. Facing it. I mean, I really, and that's why, too, we chant with our eyes open. Buddha, of course, means awakened person. So it would be antithetical to do that with your eyes closed if you're trying to wake up. But you are facing this, of course, this mandala. But Nichiren, the person who first inscribed that, the 13th century Buddhist reformer who inscribed that mandala, he said, view this as a mirror. It's like a mirror for your Buddha nature, your Buddha self that is you, and never seek it outside yourself. I'm paraphrasing, but he basically says, even though this Gohanzon may appear there on the scroll, it actually exists within your 5-foot body. He was writing, obviously, to a person who was 5 feet tall. That's not, you know. Yeah, it was really powerful.
Wow. I mean, there's so many things about your experience that I think are really fascinating and very encouraging. I mean, I know guests on the podcast, some of them are like, oh, I heard it and I just jumped right in. But, you know, that is not the case for everyone, right?
It's so great. I mean, and of course, I now subsequently introduce many people who have that exact reaction. But I feel it's a great benefit that I didn't, because, of course, it's very natural. Not everyone is going to be that, you know, head first, all embracing, let me dive into the deep end kind of a person. Some people are very cautious and trepidatious. And so I can really relate to those people and encourage them.
Wow. So then after you started practicing, maybe I'll say like early on in the first couple of years, did you notice any changes in yourself and what kind of things were you chanting for early on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, enormous changes. The other thing I'll say is other people notice changes. I mean, I was temping at a New York City office, and like within 2 weeks, people were like, what are you? Did you cut your hair, or what's different about you? What's going on? You know, and so, of course, I started telling them all about chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. But yes, many changes, including my career. I was at that point an actor and directing theater. And within about a year, I'd had a real breakthrough and said, I really want to be a writer. That definitely would not have happened if I weren't chanting. And I started to chant to be able to become a writer and to work in television and film, and all of these things started to happen. And of course, it's not magic. Buddhism is, it's so infinitely complex, but in many ways, it's very simple. You make up your mind, as Nichiren wrote, you must simply make up your mind. And so you make up your mind. What's your decision? What's your determination? What do you want to happen? Then you chant about that, and then you take action. And so that's what I did repeatedly, over and over and over again for many years, and was able to change my career and do things that probably never would have happened were I not practicing Buddhism. And again, not because Buddhism is some magical, you know, magic wand or magic power. It's just, you know, Nichiren also wrote, you must master your mind, not let your mind master you. And so, you know, to go back to that initial experience I had, I was definitely a person who I think was overwhelmed by fear in a lot of ways. And this practice helps you face your fears. I think, you know, in many ways, I think the biggest change for me has been this facing of fear. You know, that's something you have to keep at, because fear never goes away in the world.
Yeah. You know, I know that you had started seeing these changes in your life, started really developing your Buddhist practice, but then something, you know, very unexpected happened that really challenged you in new ways. So I'm wondering if you can share that story.
Of course. Yeah. So my son had been born, my older son, Charlie. He was in kindergarten. We had moved to Los Angeles because I'd gotten a great TV job, and then that had led to another one, and then another one, and had an agent, and things were really going very, very well. I was writing on a sketch comedy show, and my mother called on my cell phone and said, I don't know how to tell you this, but your brother has died. And I was just, I fell onto the floor, like literally. I was just stunned. I mean, my brother was 36 years old when he died. His name was Ben, and he He was an incredible human being, a beautiful person, extraordinarily talented artist, singer, songwriter, pyrographer. And he struggled a lot, but still, he was a very solid person. And this was such a shock to us. And it was a mixed drug reaction. You know, he had back surgery, so he was on pain medication, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we went to pick up our son from kindergarten and told him that Uncle Ben had died. And we had to go back to New York right away. And we went back to our apartment and threw a bag together. And sort of instinctually, I grabbed this book off our altar where we would chant in the morning and the evening. And this friend of ours had actually sent it to us from London. And it's called A Piece of Mirror and Other Essays by Daisaku Ikeda. And as I had shared with you before, Daisaku Ikeda was at that time, and he's passed away now, but he was at that time the president of our Buddhist organization. I had enormous respect for him, enormous respect. Brilliant mind and an extraordinary human being in terms of what he achieved with all of his efforts to spread this Buddhist practice and the philosophy of global humanism around the world and all the dialogues he had. I mean, he just blew me away. I grabbed this book just thinking I need something to read. And I'm on the plane and I'm sobbing. I mean, really just inconsolable. I don't even think I could reenact it right now. It had so taken over my life, this shock that I was in. And eventually I pulled this book out of my backpack. And sure enough, in the book, there is an essay called Life and Death. And in it, Daisaku Ikeda writes, on a very practical level, death is necessary. If people live forever, they would eventually start to long for death. Without death, we would face a whole new array of problems, from overpopulation to people having to live forever in aged bodies. Death makes room for renewal and regeneration. Death should therefore be appreciated like life as a blessing. Buddhism views death as a period of rest, like sleep, by which life regains energy and prepares for new cycles of living. Thus, there is no reason to fear death, to hate, or seek to banish it from our minds. And this really struck me hard. And I knew these ideas, and I'd shared these ideas with our son, because he was even at 4 years old, 5 years old, really, of course, very wisely starting to ask about death. I mean, Nichiren and Daishonin famously wrote, first learn about death, then learn about other things. So it's great when kids ask about it, and it's great to have a cosmology where you can explain what Daisaku Ikeda has just explained here that I've read. But still, of course, I was grieving. And of course, the next essay in the book is called Coping with Loss. And it's an incredibly wonderful essay, and it really helped me a lot. And I can just share two quotes from it. He says, a person who meets with a great tragedy will not quite naturally be at a loss as to what to do with their life. I believe one has to decide whether to keep up one's spirits and go on living with all one's might, or let oneself be broken by disappointment. Through struggling to overcome the pain and sadness that accompanies death, we become more aware of the dignity of life and can come to share the sufferings of others as our own. So I shared some of this in the eulogy that I had to give 2 days later for my brother. And afterward, my cousin came up to me at the reception, and he said to me, John, that was so beautiful. I can't believe you had the fortitude to get up there and say those words and write those words. And who was that guy you quoted? And I said, oh, that was my mentor. You know, we talk in Buddhism about unities all the time, onenesses. Technically, the term is funi in Japanese, which doesn't actually mean oneness. It means two, but not two. So these two things are separate. Daisaku Ikeda and John Plummer are very separate, right? But of course, even though we're two, we're also not two. We're absolutely united. I think in our mission, which is to be aware of the dignity of life and share the sufferings of others as our own. And to me, that having a unity with somebody who teaches you how to be that way, there is no greater treasure. And that was the beginning of a huge change in my practice. So that was a really powerful thing. And to me, that was taking this death of my brother and using it. And of course, the other thing I'll quickly say is that there have been many, many people since then who I know who have lost a family member that I've been able to do what Daisaku Ikeda describes in this book, Shakyamuni teaching us to do, which is to just be with the person. Just be there with them. You don't have to say some brilliant thing. You don't have to tell them what to do, anything. You just have to feel with them. I mean, that's what compassion literally means, is to feel with. So anyway.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. As you were speaking, I was thinking, like, it sounds almost like the difference between maybe like understanding with like your mind and understanding maybe more with your life. Like, this is the kind of life that I want to live. I want to, I don't know. I can't quite put words on it.
I think you're right. And, you know, as I said, I am a intellectual type of fellow. And I've been kind of a brain first person. And then other things come later. But, you know, that's okay. I mean, that's just who I am. I don't need to, like, change that. What I certainly have been able to do since realizing that Daisaku Ikeda is my mentor and studying the way he operated, and again, I'm not trying to mimic him or anything like that, but I'm just learning from him, is I've shortened the amount of time it takes to go from the head to the heart. Much, much short. I will say too, he introduced me to Walt Whitman. I'm sure you know, he was a great lover of Whitman and his epic poem, Leaves of Grass, and was really influenced by Whitman's writing. And what he taught me is that you can have this relationship with somebody who's dead. He never knew Whitman, but Whitman was his brother in his heart. And Whitman wrote about death in his poem, Leaves of Grass. He says, what do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death. And if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it and ceased the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward. Nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Has anyone supposed it is lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it.
Wow.
Reading Whitman, I wrote a whole season of this series. I wrote Granite Flats, where the whole third season was impacted by Leaves of Grass, and every episode contained a piece of the poem. But the themes of it, you know, these ideas, that was all in there. That's where learning from Daisaku Ikeda really has impacted my life, my work, the way I am with people. So,
yeah, wow. I too am someone that's very like logical, and you know, I tend to explain Buddhism in very like just matter of fact, logical terms. You know, think of it as a science experiment, and you know that works for many people.
Yes, and it's all true.
It's all true. But yeah, I also am like over time really like kind of deepening what it means to understand Buddhism with my heart and be able to share it with people and talk about it with my heart rather than just from this like really logical kind of perspective. So
Nichiren uses the word for heart, the character for heart or mind. They're sort of interchangeable. And Daisaku Ikeda explains he uses that character more than any other character in the writings of Nichiren. And Daisaku Ikeda says that the most important line in all of Nichiren's writings is, it is the heart that matters most. But you know, what I love about Buddhism too is that the mind and the heart are interchangeable. So we don't have to think didactically that it's, you know, well, I'm an intellect person and I'm an emotional person. I can be both of those people.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. I mean, often I think very much in like binaries. And so this was a really great reminder that like we can hold both of those things. Yeah, this is such a great dialogue. Thank you so much. And I know, of course, that this was a pivotal moment in many ways. But as everyone who practices Buddhism knows, there's always
another pivotal moment coming.
Exactly. So I think this is a couple of years ago. You had kind of a big shift in your life and family and understanding yourself. So please, yeah, if you could share.
These things are all connected too in so many ways. Yeah, so a couple of years ago, it was right before Christmas, and my older son, Charlie, who was no longer in kindergarten, who was an adult, a very successful professional actor and a wonderful human being, an amazing young man who had taught me so much and had been teaching me since he was born. I mean, really. And that's another Buddhist idea that parents can learn from their children. We can view our children as teachers, and we should, because we need to learn from them. And so this was an experience of me really learning from Charlie, too. Yeah, we had just kind of been going through a tough time, COVID, and I'm sure as everyone listening to this knows, we went through a global pandemic, and it put some strains on people in weird ways. But it's all good, because Buddhism has this concept of changing poison into medicine, or changing suffering into joy. And as Daisaku Ikeda articulates, it's not alchemy. The substance of poison doesn't change magically into medicine. We make the poison medicine by how we use it. So this is sort of an experience about that, but it's really about even something deeper. My son, right before Christmas, I'd been badgering him to get his COVID booster. It was just the last straw. And he hit the wall with me and he said, "Dad, I don't want to talk for a few days." And a few days turned into a few weeks, and he didn't come home for Christmas. This caused great discord. We're a very close family. We're all creative people. We're all artists. The kids have had an unusual upbringing where Charlie's on sets a lot of the time. My wife, Maya, is going with him, or I would be going with him, you know, and just so we're very, very close. So he said, "I need a break and I don't want to talk for a while." And a while turned into a month. And he was talking to my wife, but he didn't want to talk to me and didn't really understand it. You know, at first, again, intellectually, I was like, well, this is natural. And he never went to college because he was so working and so successful. He didn't need to. So maybe this is that. But it started to feel like, no, this is much more and this is much deeper. And something's really wrong. And the great thing about the SGI community is that we can reach out to friends and say, hey, this is going on. So May and I reached out to this friend of ours who lives in New York and had a Zoom and shared all these things. And he said, you know, a couple of really powerful things to us. One was that, "I know you feel that you're right now, and you may even be right, but it doesn't matter because you're unhappy and your son's unhappy. So please, instead of focusing on being right, please chant to create value." Our organization, Soka Gakkai — Gakkai means society or community, and Soka means value creation. So he was basically saying, do some Soka, chant for Soka, chant to create value from this situation. And so that was helpful. But the really deep thing that he shared was this idea of one great evil. So Nichiren wrote in his landmark treatise on establishing the correct teaching for the peace of the land, he wrote, "Rather than offering up 10,000 prayers for remedy, it would be better simply to outlaw this one evil." And then Daisaku Ikeda, expounding on this, says, "This passage tells us that in order to attain prosperity and peace for our society, rather than debating various methods and programs, it's better to first of all put an end to the one evil of erroneous beliefs, the fundamental cause of all unhappiness." And of course, now this is me talking, the most erroneous belief is that we're separate from each other, that we're different. And then Daisaku Ikeda continues, he says, "This also applies to our own lives as individuals. For example, let's say there's a person who gets sick because she doesn't get enough sleep or otherwise take care of herself properly. That neglect of her health is the one evil in her life. Unless she remedies that, no amount of proper nourishment will restore her to health. In the same way, there is one evil that obstructs us from carrying out our human revolution and becoming happy. Your one evil may be becoming careless and belittling yourself when things don't go as you'd hoped. Another one evil is blaming one's failings and unhappiness on others and being unable to work together in harmony with others for Kozen Rufu," which means widely spreading Buddhism. He says, "The tendency to give up and try to escape every time a difficulty presents itself is another one evil. There are many other sorts of these one evils depending upon the person. The beginning of the challenge of human revolution starts with identifying the one evil in your own life, deciding to eliminate it, earnestly chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, and challenging yourself to succeed." So my friend shared this with me. This is from a book that Daisaku Ikeda wrote called The New Human Revolution. And it hit me hard. Because I'm reading, the beginning of the challenge of your human revolution starts with identifying the one evil in your own life. And I thought, man, I'm chanting for 26 years. I thought I'd been doing human revolution all along. What's going on here, right? And I even thought I had a good idea of what my one evil was, which is my desire to control others. And I could even see that with my son, like the straw that broke the camel's back with us was me trying to get him to get this booster shot. Because my friend encouraged me to chant this way, I started to chant, I'm going to identify my one evil. I'm going to identify it. And the more I chanted, within a few days, it was very clear. It just came bubbling up out of me as I was chanting. I'm afraid of losing. I'm afraid of loss, which really is afraid of death. And so this is such a profound realization, because I realized, why am I bugging him to get the vaccine? I'm afraid he's going to die, which is, of course, irrational on one level. He's not going to die. But my brother died when he was 36, suddenly, unexpectedly. But then the more I chanted about it, the more I realized I've had this fear way before my brother died. Way. This goes back, like, when I was a child, I would be afraid that when my dad would go on away on a business trip, he would never come back. You know, this is karma, right? This is what we call karma, which is simply the accumulation of all the things we've said and thought and done in our lifetimes, throughout many, many lifetimes. And so I realized, wow, this is it. I'm going to eliminate this. And this is the idea of changing your karma into your missions. Because once you become aware of your karma, now you can do something with it, right? Now you can use the poison to make medicine by the way in which you use the poison. And so every time I would have a desire to text my son or call my son, because he'd really ask for distance, I would chant. I would, instead of wanting to call him or text him, I would run to, you know, sit down in front of my Gohanzon and face, you know, as we talked about earlier, at the very beginning, the first time I sat in front to chant the Gohanzon, I felt like I was facing my fears. And there I was again, facing fears and facing this fear of loss. And I thought, you know what? I may never speak to him again. And if that's the case, what do I want for him? What I want is for him to become happy, to become strong, to not depend on me, to not have me badgering him to get the booster shot or telling him to do this with his career or whatever. I want him to be able to do those things and make those decisions and become the most capable version of himself that he can be. And so I just chanted that way for several months. And then in May, shortly before his birthday, I was working on a script and my phone vibrates and it's my son, Charlie. And I couldn't believe it. I picked up the phone and he said, "Hey, Dad, I just thank you so much for giving me space and giving me time. And I've been doing a lot, you know, changing a lot about myself." And I said, "Me too, man. Me too." you know, and of course, I will say that, you know, I think our relationship is, of course, relationships are always ongoing, dynamic things, but I think it's gotten a lot better. It's different. It's changed in really, really good ways. And I'm still, but I will say I'm still working and chanting every day. How can I deepen my respect for him? How can I deepen my prayer for myself that I keep doing? As I said, that quote I read came from a book called The New Human Revolution. This idea of changing yourself, of turning yourself around, forcing yourself to see from a different perspective, forcing yourself to hear things in a different way, and then forcing yourself to behave differently. Again, there, this treasure of having this, and I still have it written down as one of my determinations that I look at every day, eliminate my fear of loss. And it doesn't mean, again, back to Daisaku Okada's words, it doesn't mean you don't feel sad when someone dies. Of course. I mean, I've lost many people. Many people die. Of course you're sad. But there's a difference between being sad and, like I said, like letting that flow through you and trying to hold on to it, which is an unwillingness to let go. And I feel like that's something I have to keep working on. As I said to my then fiance, this is something I need to do for my life. This is something I need to do for the rest of my life and keep doing.
What I really love about this experience and the way that you explain it is we have many moments in our life that are really kind of, we're shifting something deep inside, this kind of human revolution, we're revolving yes. ourselves to see things in a new way. And every time it's like we get just a little deeper and deeper and more solid.
Yes.
You know, I think when I first started practicing, it was like, I oftentimes felt like, oh, I can't really see clearly. Like, I just have so many, I'm a very emotional person. I have like so many big emotions and anxieties. And I know that chanting makes me feel better, but I don't really understand it. And I still feel so kind of tossed about by the waves of my life. And with time, each kind of big shift that I've had, it gets easier and harder. You know, easier in the sense that I feel more grounded. I kind of know what I'm doing, but it's harder the deeper that you go. Like, oh, wow, I'm really excavating something, something new.
Yeah. Well, that's a great metaphor, right? Excavation, because the deeper you go to dig, the harder the digging becomes. But I mean, this is why Buddhist practice exists, is to, and that's why I think it's so wonderful that it's a daily practice. It's hard. Life is hard. Every day we have challenges. So shouldn't we therefore have a practice that exists to meet those daily challenges?
Yes, absolutely. When I think about the times that I'm like really just like pushing forward, even though it's hard, I feel like, you know, I only have this one life. How do I really want to live it?
Right.
You know, every day is so precious. So if challenging myself helps me create such deeper meaning for everything in my life, I want to live a life of like deep, profound meaning.
Yes.
Not just kind of, you know, going through the motions every day and checking out after a long day of work. So I feel like, yeah, I'm now really feeling that even though it's quite challenging, it's just so deeply meaningful. That, and that's what makes it worth it.
I mean, Buddhism is a lot about being true to yourself. And when I started chanting, sometimes my wife would say, hey, why don't we chant? I'd say, oh, I'm kind of in my head right now. I don't think so, or I'm not in a great mood. As if like you have to wait to become the Buddha and then you can chant. The reason you're chanting is actually to clear all that stuff out. So, you know, now I know chant just as you are. So sometimes I'll chant and I'll be very angry and I'll, you know, sound like I'm yelling at my Buddha nature, which I am, kind of like, wake up, where are you? And sometimes I'm crying, you know, and sometimes I'm laughing. Sometimes I will be chanting and I'll just start bursting into laughter because something has come into my mind and heart that's so funny and so beautiful, you know, and often it's about the profundity of life itself, you know, like all this stuff is awesome, you know, all these things are, we can just use them, you know. It's important to embrace the darkness. You know, Buddhism doesn't try to banish the darkness. Again, oneness, right? So dark and light are one. And so we try to really embrace it. Daisaku Ikeda wrote this poem about Walt Whitman, and in it he writes, true cheer, true brightness is the flash of an illumined spirit resolved in its convictions, piercing the dark night of grief. Isn't that amazing? I mean, so like, in other words, don't be a phony, don't be fake cheerful, fake bright. Real cheer only comes when you're in the, you might be in the midst of grief, but you're going to determine, I'm going to pierce right through that grief, you know. That grief itself becomes the engine. Like, my writing has completely changed since my brother's death, deepened. And, you know, all these experiences, it's become more of my Buddhist mission. Like I said, like that whole season I wrote about Leaves of Grass, I never would have written that before my brother had died. Never in a million years. But I felt, no, I need to, you know, teach people about these ideals, these ideas, this way of being that Daisaku Ikeda articulates, that Walt Whitman articulates. Let me try to put that into my work somehow. And so that's become very much my mission, is to put these faith ideas and these student-teacher ideas and using darkness to create light and all of that. That's gone much more into my writing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. you know, a couple months ago, I was talking to a young man who's a jazz musician. And in our conversation, we were talking about the connection between Buddhism and his music. And really, he was saying the music is just like the notes, right? Right. Whatever you're doing in life, it's just a reflection of your inner self, you know? So the notes can be whatever they are. But if your life isn't really like fighting and really joyful and really like full and deep, then the art is going to reflect, you know, either that emptiness or fullness, right? Yeah,
absolutely. And to me, if you're grappling with your that true self, which is one of the four virtues that Buddhism articulates, and then as an artist anyway, speaking as an artist, if you're grappling with that, then your work is going to grapple with that. And then anybody can relate to it. Anybody. So.
Oh, absolutely. And thinking about how far you've come in terms of like grappling with your true self in the time that you've started practicing, I actually wanted to kind of close us out by bringing it back to the beginning. So it took you 10 years to really find the courage to chant. So I'd love to hear what you might say now to someone who's in a kind of a similar spot that you were in. Either they don't really want to try chanting, or maybe they're struggling to find the courage to try it.
I would say that's okay. You don't have to chant if you don't want to, but it won't hurt you. And maybe by chanting, you might realize you're afraid of something. And also maybe by chanting, you might realize you love something, but you don't want to say that or don't want to feel it. Daisaku Ikeda was giving encouragement to a woman was struggling with her son. He said, you know, everybody has worries and I have worries. You know, it's natural to have worries. You have worries about your son. But the greatest expression of faith is love. And that really struck me deeply. That's really what we're doing when we chant Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. I mean, Nam means I devote myself to. And so in a lot of ways, that repetition of Nam Myoho Renge Kyo is a declaration of love for yourself, for your family, your friends, your community, the world, you know, your environment, even people you don't like, that you can love them and that they need love too. That's probably part of the reason you don't like them is because they desperately need love. And so to me, if you're into love or truth or facing fears, then give chanting a try because it will bring up all of those things in you. And it will also, as we talked about, it will revolve you a little bit. It will change you. It absolutely will change you. And even if you take it up and just try it one time, and Nichiren says, even if you just hear it, your life will be immeasurably impacted.
This conversation came at a great time for me. I've really been digging deeper into the Buddhist perspective on death. And so I've been reading a book called Unlocking the Mysteries of Birth and Death by Daisaku Ikeda. In it, he writes, Montaigne said, to philosophize is to learn to die. Similarly, Buddhism teaches us, first learn about death and then about other matters. As both statements suggest, learning about death enriches life. How we perceive the meaning of death and the meaning of life hinges completely on whether we can establish a correct view of life and death. Goethe says, those who have no hope of another life are already dead in this one. We study Buddhism to live vibrantly and with eternal hope. Will death, which inevitably comes to each of us, be a time of dignity and honor, or will we end in pitiful demise? This is completely reliant on how we live our lives right now, today. In that sense, the moment of death truly exists in the present. If you've similarly been interested in this topic and want to dig a little bit deeper, we've left some resources in the show notes to check out. And as always, you can reach out to us at connect@buddhability.org to get connected with a local Buddhist community and learn more about this practice. For next week's episode, we want to know one aspect of your identity that's important to you and why. You can reach out to us by email, or you can wait for our Instagram story next week. Until next time, thanks for listening.